It's nice to be back on our Saturday night talks, and as we wind our way through winter, the sunshine helps a bit too, so it's not that hard to take. In any case, ladies and gentlemen, our lecture tonight is part of the Cecil and Ida Green Visiting Professorship Program at UBC, and with us tonight is the current head of that program, Dr. Richard Erickson, and I'd like you to help welcome Richard and Dr. Kenneth Craig, who's the professor of psychology at UBC, who's helping to host our speaker tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, our special guests. Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker tonight, Dr. Patrick McGrath, has spent a lifetime in an endeavor that would touch anyone's heart. He received his undergraduate education at the University of Saskatchewan, and he went on to take his PhD from Queen's University and studied as a career scientist at the University of Ottawa. He is currently professor of psychology, pediatrics, psychiatry, and biomedical engineering at Dalhousie University. That seems to like a lot of things together, Patrick. He's also a psychologist at the IWK Grace Health Center in Nova Scotia. He's received many awards for his research from such organizations as Bristol-Myers Squibb, the Canadian Psychological Association, the Medical Research Council of Canada, and of course the IWK Grace Health Center. In 1995, he was elected Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and received a Killam Professorship in the year 2001. Dr. McGrath has published 123 papers, 36 book chapters, 10 books, and 5 patient booklets. Among his books are, and I think the titles are interesting, Help Yourself, A Treatment for Migraine Headaches, Making Cancer Less Painful, A Handbook for Parents, interestingly, and the one I like the most, of course, is Pain, Pain, Go Away, Helping Children with Pain, which is a very touching Patrick title. Tonight, Dr. McGrath will draw on his renowned expertise in diagnosis and treatment of pain in children, and he's chosen as his title, The Burden of Children's Pain. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Patrick McGrath.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I understand it was typical Vancouver weather today, and I threw away my umbrella, so I'm going to talk to you today about a topic that a large group of scientists and professionals have been working on for many years, and I think we've made some progress. I wanted to thank, first of all, the Vancouver Institute for inviting me, the Green College, delightful institution, and also, it's very funny when you come into a center where there are people that are doing the same work, and in Vancouver, there are some distinguished scientists, clinicians in pain, in pediatric pain, Ken Craig, Ruth Grunau, Christine Chambers, Tim Oberlander, recently joining the group in Vancouver, Faye Warnock, and some very distinguished clinician scientists, Sue Bennett, Leora Kuttner. All of these people have international reputations in pediatric pain, so it feels a little bit funny to be talking in their backyard, and I appreciate their courtesy in having me come. I want to go through a series of arguments. My argument basically is we'll go with some pain is useful, that pain in children is common, in spite of what we may have the view of children, that they don't have a lot of pain, that infants, children, and adolescents have more limited resources available to them to deal with pain, that pain is often minimized by adults, and in many circumstances, pain is inflicted on children by adults. The pain has long and short-term consequences that are of great significance, but that we have made progress and we will continue to make progress. And that's basically the story that I want to tell you. Let's start with some pain is useful. Many people who have chronic pain think, of course, that pain is only a curse. But pain is absolutely essential. It teaches to avoid danger. My daughter, when she was young, if she would touch something that was hot, she'd learn that you don't do that because it hurt. It signals tissue damage. So if you have something wrong, if you have an ear infection, you have tonsillitis, you have a cut or a broken arm, it tells you that there's something wrong and you've got to do something about it. Children who lack any sensation of pain, and there are a small number of children like this, they injure themselves repeatedly, they cause themselves a great deal of damage, they have accidents, they mutilate themselves, they chew parts of their tongue off and they're inside of their mouths. And because they don't notice this, they develop more infection, they develop more disease, they injure themselves more frequently, and most of them die very young. So pain is not all bad. It has a very useful function. However, pain becomes a burden when there is no communication value or signal value to either oneself or to a caregiver. So when you lose the signal value, when you lose that communication value, then pain doesn't have any use. In chronic pain and in many types of medical pain, there is no need to signal. We know that when we stick a needle in somebody that it's going to hurt. By the time somebody has chronic pain for many, many months or years, they don't need to be signaled that it hurts. There's no ongoing tissue damage in many cases, and what they need to do is just get rid of the pain. So it becomes a burden. Now, pain is really quite common in children. We did a study a number of years ago, and there's been a replication of that study in which we had a graduate student sit in a daycare watching while children fell down and hurt themselves. You may wonder, why would anybody want to do that? But we have a class of graduate students that sometimes like to do things that are strange, and in our group we do those things. What we found was that children hurt themselves on average about once every 3 hours. You know, most mothers would tell you, oh, well, of course they do. You know, that's what kids are like. And in a daycare, with all of the activity, that's indeed what happens. These are not serious injuries, but injuries that perhaps that don't cause any lasting damage, that don't cause any bruising, but they would fall down and hurt themselves. There's little response from caregivers. Most of the time, caregivers simply ignore these incidents and the children go on and keep on playing. Some of the gender differences begin to show up there. Girls respond more when they hurt themselves than do boys in that circumstance. Girls get more attention for having pain in that circumstance, even if you control for the extent of their behavior. The other thing that's very interesting is that children who have more of these incidents actually show a stronger reaction. So even in daycare, we've begun to study the incidence of pain. In another study done by our group, we did a survey of 693 children, and we asked them to keep a diary for a week. Again, these were kids up to about age 12. We began to see, even at that age, a differences between girls and boys. Girls had 3 incidents a week of pain on average, and boys had 2 incidents of any pain a week. If you take moderate or severe pain lasting 3 or more hours, girls on average had about 1 incident of pain a week, and boys had about 1 incident every 2 weeks. So you see, even at that age, in these everyday pain, most of these children would not receive medical attention for these. There's a wide variety of pains, everything from a sprained ankle to a sore throat to a headache or a tummy ache. In a study done in Scandinavia looking at musculoskeletal pain, close to 2,000 children in the third and fifth grade, they looked at pain, and they found that 32% had weekly pain. So we usually think of children as not having a lot of pain, but here you're getting into musculoskeletal pain, and a third of them have weekly pain. Half of the children, when they surveyed them a year later, were still having musculoskeletal pain. And it tended to be girls tended to persist in their pain. The older children were more likely to have continuing pain. And children with neck pain tended to have continuing pain. Back pain. 10 or 15 years ago, it was generally believed that the only children that had back pain were children that had some significant pathological condition. And so that if a child came to a physician with back pain, they were very much alerted to serious medical problems. When we do epidemiological studies, when we do studies where we go and ask children about their pain, we find that back pain is really quite common. So you see, at 7 years, if you'll notice this not working pointer, at 7 years, you see that back pain is really quite rare. 10 years, you get up to 8% of boys and about 4% of girls. Once you move into the teenage years, you see that there are a lot more boys and girls, and again, girls have the edge on boys and tend to have more pain. But up to 20% of girls by 14 and 16 years of age have back pain. Now, this is a little bit of a busy slide, but I'll walk you through it. This is a study that was done in Rotterdam and was looking at all types of pain. And the first two of each age group are the amount of chronic pain. That's pain that they've had for more than 3 months. And then the second two are looking at pain that is both chronic, it's been lasting for more than 3 months, it's frequent, it occurs more than once a week, and it is more severe. On a scale of 0 to 10, it would be in the 5 range or higher. So in the 0 to 3 and the 4 to 7 years, these were by reports by the parents of estimates of their pain. And you can see that, again, there's a higher rate of any pain and a somewhat lower rate of the severe chronic pain, still down around just a few percent. And that remains true in the 4 to 7 years, where you have up to 20% of kids having some pain, but very few have severe and chronic pain. Once you reach 8 to 11, you can see that not only does the rate of pain increase, but more importantly, the rate of pain that is frequent, severe, and chronic. And by the time children reach 18 years of age, you're getting up to about 15% of girls and a much smaller percent of boys, less than 5% of boys, having pain that is chronic. It's lasted for more than 3 months. It's severe in that it's, again, above a 5 on a 0 to 10 scale, and it is frequent at least once a week. So we see that children and adolescents, children have less of these recurrent pains, but they still have a lot of different types of pains. And in adolescence, you begin to get more frequent pains, more severe pains, and you get a sizable percentage of children, a significant percentage of children that are having severe pain that is frequent and is lasting for a long period of time. Now, children have fewer resources to deal with pain than do adults. In terms of internal resources, those resources that they can draw upon themselves, children, although they have a talent for distraction, and anybody who's observed carefully or dealt with a young child will know that it's very easy to distract a child. They may be crying at one moment, and then you're playing with them with their favorite toy, and they seem to be very distracted, and it doesn't bother them. but they have less understanding for the reasons for pain. So, for example, a four-year-old or a three-year-old who's undergoing a medical procedure doesn't understand that the reason that you're sticking a needle in them is to help them in the future. All they know is that it hurts and they're afraid. Life for children, and the younger the child, the more this is so, is in the moment. They experience it now. That's their whole environment. That's their whole life. And so consequently, when they're in pain, they're in pain. Later on, when they're not in pain, many of them have forgotten the pain. And they also have less ability to self-regulate than do adults, and this grows with time. So in terms of distraction, by play, as I mentioned, is a very powerful distractor. By imaginary involvement, children may be thinking of something or imagining something, and it becomes real. It becomes their own, their total life. Unfortunately, I've seen this real talent used against children in the medical setting, because what happens is that somebody will say, but how can he be in pain? He was in the playroom. He was playing 10 minutes ago, and now you're saying he's in pain. Well, the thing is that children are so good at distracting themselves that they will use play, but that doesn't mean that they're not in pain, and it doesn't mean that they won't need something to help their pain, because they won't be able to play all of the time. They're going to have to be, you know, they're going to be doing other things, and they're going to be less distracted, and they're going to need some help, perhaps in the form of medication. Self-regulation, as you know, children at the early days cannot really think or reflect on things in order to make them happen. So children are very good at distracting themselves, but they can't think about distracting themselves in order to get out of pain. They can't think about using different ways of thinking to reduce the pain. So it's not until children develop what psychologists call metacognition that they're able to think about what you have to do in order to get out of pain, especially when you're using things that are cognitive, like distraction and changing the way you're imagining something or thinking about it. In adolescence, of course, self-regulation is quite possible, and this is just some data from a study on migraine headaches. And the two lines that go down are data from a study in which we taught children, adolescents, to use distraction, to use muscle relaxation, to use thinking differently about their pain in order to control migraine headaches. And this type of stress management is been shown to be the best treatment for adolescents with either tension headaches or migraine headaches, and has been replicated in many different studies over the years. And the green line is simply the control condition, where we gave them a placebo psychological intervention, and it wasn't very effective. So demonstrating it's not just that people were paying attention to them, but they actually learned some skills. The study itself was a study comparing face-to-face treatment with more distance treatment. Well, much of it was delivered on the phone with manuals and audio tapes. And we found that the two ways of delivering the treatment were equally effective. Children have limited external resources. In our society, children, in one sense, are put on a pedestal. Everything revolves around the children. But at the same time, children are devalued. Their opinions aren't taken seriously. They're often not really given the right to have what they need for their best interests. They have no political power. Although your politicians and our politicians in Nova Scotia behave in a childish manner, we say, the children aren't the ones that were electing them. They have no physical power, in terms of physical power. They may spend a lot of money, or their parents may spend a lot of money on them, but they don't control resources. They have no voice. Children really have no voice except through the goodwill and knowledge of the people who take care of them. They can cry, but they can't lodge a complaint again in the College of Physicians and Surgeons about inadequate care. They can complain to their parents, but I have yet to see the CEO of a hospital receive a letter from a child because they didn't get the right pain management. Unfortunately, we don't get enough letters going to the CEOs about adults not getting proper pain management, but at least adults have the potential for doing that. There's limited external resources, and I want to focus a little bit on the science. There's been very, compared to adult pain and children's pain, there's been really very little research done on this topic. In the basic science, science that is designed simply to understand the phenomena, which would include basic biological science and also basic developmental psychology of pain in children, because this communication that I was talking to you about before hasn't been well investigated. The clinical science really began only in the 1980s, and there has been a tremendous growth of clinical science, looking for clinical investigations, looking for treatments, looking for measurements of pain. There's been major changes and advances, but we only started in the 1980s, and there really are a limited number of scientists looking at this. Most of the work has been done on measurement and on treatment. And measurement has preoccupied scientists in children's pain to a great extent in the early years, because without measurement, without being able to measure pain in children, it's very difficult to develop a science, because without some sort of measurement, how can you tell whether or not you're having pain, whether you're having more or less pain, whether or not your treatments are effective? The social science of pain in children has really not been developed very well. In fact, one of the few areas in the world where this work is being done is here at UBC. And again, health systems research. How does the health system respond to pain in children? How does the pain in children affect the delivery of health care? There's been virtually no research in this area, and it's an area that is crying out for a great deal more consideration, certainly in terms of managing the types of pains that children have. Some groups of children have more burden and fewer resources. I'm going to briefly talk about four groups of children: children who are cognitively impaired, neonates, females, which I've been talking about all along, and so I'll just mention that briefly, and the chronically ill. Starting with children with cognitive impairment. Children with cognitive impairment, children who are slow to develop cognitively, are developmentally delayed, what used to be called mental retardation, these children are at high risk for problems, because almost all children with very severe cognitive impairment will have comorbid conditions. You don't see a child that is severely impaired with only that problem. What they have is they may have heart problems. They may have problems with mobility. They probably have orthopedic problems. So there's a broad range of problems that they have, all of which put them at higher risk for pain. Of course, children with severe cognitive impairment have limited communication skills. They're not even less able to talk to their parents about what the problem is. They often have unusual behavior. So it's not surprising to see a child with a very severe cognitive impairment who will all of a sudden make a noise, cry out. Even whether or not they're in pain, they may do that. Children may have facial grimaces that looked very unusual and difficult for many people to interpret. Cognitively impaired children are devalued in our society. Now, those people who care for cognitively impaired children usually don't feel that way and usually are very caring and concerned about them. But in general, people who are cognitively impaired are considered by our society as not deserving the resources that people who aren't cognitively impaired. So if you have the budgets for settings that have children with cognitively impairment, certainly in my own province, are just disgraceful. We just don't serve this population. And again, there has been extraordinarily small amounts of research on pain in this population. Just some data on terms of their high risk for pain. A study that one of my graduate students and ourselves have been doing. We looked at 94 children, their caregivers. These are children who are from 5 to 18 years of age, but they're functioning at less than about 18 months of age. 78% of these children had pain 9 to 10 hours a week that was rated by their parents as about 6 out of 10. We've spent about 2 years developing measures that are appropriate for these children, and so we're fairly confident that these measures are fairly accurate. The types of pain that they get are accidental pain. They get their hand jammed in the wheelchair. Somebody doesn't, you know, when they're moving them, their arm moves over this way. They bump into things. They have gastrointestinal problems. Many of these children suffer from reflux. Many of them are constipated. The musculoskeletal problems. Many of them are not walking, are not able to use their arms. They have contractures. They get infections. They get infections at a higher rate than normal children do. They have recurrent pains of various sorts, everything from headaches to menstrual pain. They have medical procedures at a much higher rate than do other children. So if you go to a children's hospital and you walk in the wards or go to the operating room, you will see a very high percentage of children who have severe cognitive impairment because they have so many comorbid conditions and require so much treatment. The children that were more delayed had more pain. So it appears that within this population, the more delayed you are, the more likely you are to have pain. Now, I want to talk briefly about children who have been murdered by their parents. And the most famous case has been the Tracy Latimer case. And as you know, Tracy was a child with cerebral palsy. She was severely impaired. And her father, out of frustration, felt that she was in so much pain that he felt that her life wasn't worth living. The message that I want to give you here on that is not whether or not he should have done this. Of course he shouldn't have done this. But we all have to have some understanding of the distress that he is in and the fact that we have to value the lives of children like this so that this should never happen. This family was not given, for many, many different reasons, sufficient assistance with managing her pain in order to survive this very difficult situation that they were in. And it is not an isolated case. There have been a whole series of children and young adults who are killed because the parents felt that their situation was intolerable. And it's not always pain. It may be the burden of caring, the suffering that they're undergoing, and these are just some of the kids that have had that. So Kathy Wilkinson, Hamilton, 1995. Bernard Halpin, 1996, in Montreal. Daniel Blais, Montreal, 1997. And Maurice and their 34-year-old son, Reese, was murder-suicide again just in BC in 2002. So the desperation felt by parents
with these children, I think should speak to us all that there's something profoundly wrong that we all collectively have to take responsibility for. And of course, they have to take responsibility for their own behavior as well. I want to talk a little bit about neonates. Neonates are just little babies. And this is a study that was done by Celeste Johnson, who's a nurse in Montreal and a close colleague of all of ours. She looked at 239 patients in 14 neonatal intensive care units. This is a picture of the type of baby that would be involved in the study. They had 2,134 procedures. They did a survey for a week, and what they did was that they had forms that was filled out by whoever was caring for the child all the time. It was right on the chart, and whenever they had an invasive procedure, it was marked. They had, on average, about two procedures a day, everything from heel lances, when you take a needle and you put it into their heel to get some blood, and chest tube insertions, where you take a chest tube and you put it into their chest to get drainage. Medication was given for 0.8%. Not 8%, 0.8% of the procedures. Even procedures such as arterial punctures and lumbar punctures, only 14% of those children got any medication. And many of those were getting the medication because of post-operative pain, not because of that. In contrast, children who had surgery frequently, almost always, were getting post-operative pain management. This is a great progress over what had been done 15 years previously. Because 15 years previously, many children in the neonatal intensive care unit would not be getting post-operative pain management. As I mentioned, females, especially past puberty, are at higher risk for almost all pains, not quite. In the young woman, menstrual pain is extremely common, tends to be worse than in older women. Migraine headache just rockets up in prevalence at puberty, and tension headache as well. These are real pains. All you women know that menstrual pain hurts, and it's a serious problem that's not well taken care of. Nobody dies from menstrual pain, but the quality of life is severely impaired if those pains aren't managed well. Many chronic illnesses in children are painful. Cancer is painful. Cancer is painful mostly actually not because of the disease. Children with cancer frequently have pain as a symptom in the early stages of their disease, and then to some extent in later stages if they're terminally ill. But they have a huge number of procedures, and it's only in the last 10 or 15 years that these procedures have been appropriately managed in many places. 10, 15 years ago, it was typical for a child to have a bone marrow aspiration where you take a needle and you put it into the hip bone and you pull out some bone marrow, which is a necessary part of staging and also of monitoring treatment, for instance, for leukemia. It was not unusual 10 or 15 years ago for the child to be given either no pain medication, or they might be given what was called a lytic cocktail, which then still resulted in at least 50% of these children having to be held down. Arthritis is a painful disease. And many children have pain with arthritis when they're in flares, and many of the children, for instance, that I've seen saw a child earlier this week who had pain from her arthritis. Constant problem. Cystic fibrosis, not in the early stages, but in later stages of cystic fibrosis. And it's only in the last 3 or 4 years that pain has been, everybody knew that these disorders had pain. It's only in the last 3 or 4 years, for instance, that rheumatologists have been considered that they're going to do something about the pain, not just about the underlying inflammation, but they're now beginning to focus more and more on how can we control the pain. And again, the research on pain in children in chronic illness is very, very limited. Pain is minimized by adults. Parents, nurses, and doctors routinely underestimate the amount of pain that children have. In studies that we and other people have done, they tend to rate the pain lower than what the child rates. And only you know what pain you're having. And if you say you have pain, unless I have very good evidence for it, I have to assume that you have pain. And typically, parents rate closer to children than nurses, although the evidence isn't always that. And doctors tend to be abysmal at it. Not because they're evil or not because they're not caring, but they tend to have the least exposure to the children in pain and therefore don't recognize the cues. 20 years ago, people were saying that neonates didn't feel pain. In fact, there were a whole series of very well-known, in our field, very well-known trials which compared giving analgesia and anesthesia for surgery, for chest surgery, open-heart surgery. And it was common practice 20 years ago, not in all hospitals, but in many hospitals, common practice not to use anesthesia for open-heart surgery in children, in infants. What they would do is that they would use a drug, a Pavilion-like drug, that would keep the child still so the surgeon could work, but not to use anything that was able to control the pain. The feeling was, is that the children couldn't feel pain, or that perhaps the anesthetic were too dangerous. Nowadays, this isn't done. But you still hear frequently when we're working with children with cognitive impairment, oh, they don't feel pain the way we do, you know. And I can't prove absolutely because I can't tell what anybody else actually feels, and these children cannot convey to me in words what they're feeling. I can't tell for sure that that's not true. But the default option, what we should always go on, is that until we have evidence, we should assume that somebody who looks like they're in pain, somebody who's had a painful procedure, that they are in pain. Lots of people still think, that underestimating pain in children will encourage coping. Well, I don't want him to give in to his pain, so that's why I don't believe him when he has pain. Or, she has to learn to live with it, you know. The problem is that children will learn, and all of us will learn to live better with our pain if it's acknowledged. There's nothing more frustrating if I have a headache and I say to my wife, well, I have a headache tonight, dear. And she says, oh, no, you don't. Well, I mean, she wouldn't do that, but you can see the frustration. But many children are put in that situation, most frequently by health professionals, less frequently by their parents. Finally, I want to detail what I call the psychogenic curse. And over the years, I've become stronger and stronger on this. What I mean by that is that the tendency for us to suggest that pain is psychologically caused can be a real curse. Now, I'm the first to admit that some pain is psychologically caused. About 20 minutes ago, I was experiencing psychogenic pain that was caused by you gentle people and the combination of the veal that I had for dinner. Okay? It was psychogenic abdominal pain. But I want to tell you about what happens is that in the health professions, you hear it all the time, I cannot figure out what pain you have. We have run all of the tests. It doesn't follow known physiology. Therefore, it's all in your head. And with the case of children, your mom, usually moms get blamed. Your mom is probably making you a bit crazy, and that's why you have this pain. This is time and time again, I perhaps would put it a little more dramatically, but time and time again, the case that we see. I blame Sigmund Freud for this, but perhaps that's unfair. I want to tell you about a couple of children that I've seen. This is the girl who couldn't straighten up. I actually saw her Friday. She's doing much better now. But she came into hospital about 18 months ago. She's 13-year-old with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She had painful legs that were hyperextended. That means that the legs were how can I do it? Her knees were going up, the wrong way up. Okay? They were rigid. They were held in that position. She was lying in bed. She's complaining of a great deal of pain. She refused to walk. She was shaking at times with the pain and crying. She stopped eating. Had to tube feed her because she wasn't getting any nutrition. Every subspecialty saw this child. And in fact, we were consulted in the pain service. And they couldn't find anything. And her major physician was saying, well, we can't find anything. We've run all the tests. And no, this doesn't follow normal physiological rules. They would say, well, Pat, it's in your hands because it's psychological. There was no evidence that it was psychological. And I was fortunate enough to be able to spend hours and hours and hours by her bed talking to her and listening to her and just trying to figure out what was going on. In frustration, I would try things like teaching her relaxation. Her legs were, her just muscles were like steel. Nothing. She wouldn't learn it. Most children, if you teach them to relax their muscles, they begin to relax them quite well. When I tried to get her to relax her muscles, when I moved her finger, it was stiff. Couldn't do it. The nice thing about Halifax is it's a small city. It's a very friendly city. So I was at the market on Saturday morning, and there was Peter Camfield, who is the chief of pediatrics and one of the neurologists that had seen this child. I said, Peter, let's have a coffee. There's something wrong with that child. There's something centrally wrong with that child. He says, they say she's psychologically impaired. I said, there's no evidence of psychological impairment. Well, her mother was very aggressive, assertive mother. Her father was 30 years older than the mother. Well, obviously something psychological about that. Okay. And I said, Peter, there's something wrong and it's not psychological. I've spent 3 hours trying to teach her to relax her hand, and her hand is stiff. He said, stiff. Stiff. Stiff man syndrome. I had never heard of this, but the neurologists know about it. There is a syndrome called stiff man syndrome. It's an autoimmune disorder, very rare. Only one other case that we could find in a child. And sure enough, he ran tests the next morning, and indeed that's what she has. She's now on plasmapheresis, and that controls the stiffness. She gets her blood washed every 2 weeks. And it controls the stiffness, and she's doing well. And she's become, she's now, again, a marvelous, bubbling, delightful child. Fourteen-year-old, cerebral palsy. Very intelligent child, very good speech. Hard to understand at times. Once you got to know him, you could understand him really well. Sociable, was in school. He was quite philosophical. He liked to talk about different things on this hand, on that hand, you know. You know how some 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds get. I didn't get that way until I was in first year university and took philosophy, but he was really quite advanced. Many children with cerebral palsy. He was in a wheelchair, confined to a wheelchair, quite severely impaired motorically. He had scoliosis. He had to have a rod inserted. Now, I was called in to see him again. The pain service gets called in when nobody can figure out what the pain is and they are tired of dealing with it. And we have a multidisciplinary pain service, an anesthetist, a psychologist, a physiotherapist, and nurse. So we were called in because he wasn't recovering very well after the surgery. He had postoperative pain in the hip, and it was very hard for him to localize it. It would move around, and it would be of different intensity at different times. Over the next couple of weeks, he just gradually shut down. He became bedridden. He couldn't tolerate his chair. He stopped being bubbly and enthusiastic. He just shut down. Again, I don't know about your family, but I came from a big family, okay? There were 10 kids, brawling Irish family. You can always find something crazy in any family. I could take any one of you, and I could find, in 3 minutes of an interview, a reason for anything. And indeed, this child's parents had some difficulties. His mother had had depression and some sort had chronic pain problem. So that was it. After a year of misery, finally another different consult, finally got another orthopedic consult, said, well, nothing seems to work. They went back in, they cut about that much off the rod. The kid got better. Of course, the person who did it and his original surgeon said, well, it was a placebo operation, but it was a success. The results of the psychogenic curse, as I call it, is bewilderment, distrust, anger, depression, self-doubt, and sometimes increased pain behavior. Nobody believes me, well, then I'll increase the amount of pain that I'm showing. The burden of pain, the short-term consequences are that pain hurts and children suffer. Healing is delayed. If you're expending energy on your pain, it's not going to healing. There are, at this point, no studies in children that demonstrates that. There are some studies in adults that demonstrate that, but nobody's done the studies in children to really look at that. And the cost of care, of course, if you're delayed, if you're in hospital longer, and again, the adult studies suggest that, child studies have not been done, the costs of care increase. The long-term sequelae, sensitization to pain. Pain has a biological memory. And although you can imagine how difficult these studies are, there has been some work done here in Vancouver. Ruth Grunau has done some excellent work following up children long-term who've had a lot of painful procedures in the neonatal intensive care unit. And although the evidence cannot be said to be absolutely clear in the human work, the animal literature is incontrovertible that pain causes more pain. There's other interesting studies in children that do show on a six-month basis that it causes increased sensitivity. Interferes with social development. Again, the animal studies are beginning to be very clear. The human studies are harder to do. You can't randomly assign somebody to have a lot of pain, and so it's really hard to know what causes what. But the animal studies are clear that that pain in the early ages interferes with learning, interferes with social development, and can lead to serious problems in terms of interactions on a social basis on things like anxiety and things like addictions later on. I want to talk a little bit about the progress that's been made, and then I'll stop in time for questions. Progress has been made because of advances in science, and as a scientist, I like to think that that's the reason why major progress is made. And indeed, there have been very, very good studies over the last 10 or 15 years looking at measurement, looking at interventions. But one of the most important things that's happened as well is that there's been significant lobbying. And I want to tell you a story about a particular mom that's absolutely stunning. Mrs. Lawson had a son named Jeffrey, and Mrs. Lawson, this child had severe problems when he was born, and was born in Washington, in not the state, but the D.C., and so she was going to have a repair to his heart, a ductus repair, because the ductus didn't close when it's supposed to when you switch over to normal breathing after you get out of the womb. And so Mrs. Lawson had heard in some women's magazines what I was telling you earlier, that people didn't use any type of anesthetic. So she went to the neonatologist who was caring for her son and said, Doctor, I understand that sometimes no anesthetic is used. I said, well, Mrs. Lawson, this is the D.C. Children's Hospital. This is one of the finest hospitals in North America. Of course we use anesthetic. The child went to surgery. Unfortunately, a short time afterwards, the child died, probably not related to surgery, but he had multiple problems. And the mom, Mrs. Lawson, she decided that what she was going to do was she was going to read the, get all the records to try and work through the grief. She went, got the records. She couldn't find in the anesthetic record any evidence of anesthesia. So she went back to the neonatologist and said, look here, I mean, there's no evidence of anesthesia. The neonatologist was stunned. He didn't know that, in fact, they didn't use anesthesia. All they did was muscle relaxants. So he went to the anesthesiologist and said, what's this? Oh, no, they don't feel pain. Well, Mrs. Lawson was not one to be fooled around with. Mrs. Lawson went to the medical board of the hospital. She made a complaint, and they offered to provide counseling for her because she couldn't deal with her grief. She went to the Washington, D.C. medical board and complained about this. And they also suggested that she get counseling. Then she went to the Washington Post, and all hell broke loose when that was on the front page, because their science was there that children felt pain. The trials had been done. They had been published. And within 3 weeks, all of the medical associations were coming out with statements about this need not to deny infants anesthetic. But it was only because Mrs. Lawson had the courage to stand up and to yell loud to make sure something was done. The American Pain Society has now established the Jeffrey Lawson Award to be given to someone who really advanced the advocacy for children's pain. And this year's winner is Dr. Craig, who's here today. And he'll be getting that in just a few weeks. And we've made a lot of progress, small footsteps anyway. Most surgery is now covered with proper anesthetic. But still, circumcisions are done without any anesthetic. And I was sympathizing with the women in the audience, but let me just ask any of your male friends if they think that circumcision is pain-free. There are good ways of controlling pain in circumcision. Some places they're done, some places they're not done. The pharmacology of pain medicine in children is just beginning to be unraveled, fear of addiction and measures, and I'm just going to talk about those briefly. In the pharmacology, after about 6 months of age, the pharmacokinetics, that means you put in a drug and then you look at the blood levels, they're about the same after 6 months. Before 6 months, they're quite different. That's because of the immature development of things like the liver and the kidneys, who may, in different drugs, may take them out. And also the amount of fat, because some of them are adhere to fat. The pharmacodynamics, does the drug affect pain in the same way? We're just beginning to do those studies. Side effects, we really don't know. This is true with opioids, with NSAIDs like ibuprofen, with acetaminophen and local anesthetics. So there's a, there's research now being done to really look at the pharmacology, and much of it has been done. The fear of addiction, the war on drugs, which our neighbors to the south have particularly pushed, may not have had any effect on drug abuse, but this war on drugs has had an effect on how parents and how adolescents feel about taking strong drugs. In studies that we've done, which we looked at post-operative pain and the use of acetaminophen or Tylenol, we found that parents often don't give their children medication, even though they say that their child is in pain. They will not give the medication because they fear that the child will become addicted to acetaminophen, or that they will learn to depend on drugs to solve problems. Children with severe pain need acetaminophen, or they need the opioid derivatives. They need the medication. Does not lead to addiction. There's no evidence that the use of pain medicine for pain leads to addiction. If you use pain medicine for fun, then it will lead to addiction. I want to talk a little bit about the measurement advances. This is a little bit about pain measurement and facial action coding system developed here by Ruth Grunau and Ken Craig. This is the type of scoring. We videotape the face. We then score it in very great detail, second by second. All of our graduate students have little squinty eyes because they spend all their time in front of the video cameras and the video screens. Other types we've developed, our own group has developed the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario Pain Scale, a behavioral measure. Christine Chambers, when she worked with us, who's now a professor here in pediatrics, developed the Parents Postoperative Pain Scale. We've looked at the non-communicating children's pain checklist. There's the Children's Facial Action System, which is an upward extension of the neonatal one with facial responses. Bonnie Stevens, a nurse in Montreal, in Toronto, has developed a premature infant pain profile. There's been a huge expansion of our ability to measure pain in infants and children. Thank you very much for your attention. And I'd be pleased to take any questions. Yes. Right. I'm sorry. My talk was not clear enough. It was with this one child who was 14 that it didn't work. We typically use relaxation, forms of meditation, deep breathing exercises with many children with things like migraine or tension-type headaches or even recurrent abdominal pain, and it often is effective. We find that below age 11, you really need a coach. So with the child, for instance, earlier this week that I was seeing who had chronic daily headache and she was 10 years old, her mother sat in with her and she would coach her when she was doing the relaxation. Above about age 10, 11, 12, children can self-regulate enough so that they can do it on their own. But there are dozens and dozens of studies, as you know, that have shown that muscle relaxation, that self-hypnosis, that meditation, deep breathing exercises can be effective with both migraine and muscle tension headaches. And there are fewer studies, but still two good, very good studies with recurrent abdominal pain. That, of course, does not mean that these conditions are because these children are more tense or more stressed than any other child. Just like if you take ibuprofen for your headache, it does not mean that you got the headache because you had an ibuprofen deficiency. Okay? It's the same thing. Of course, migraine is a well-established genetic disorder. Okay? But stress is a trigger. And what we do oftentimes is, as the gentleman was saying, we're able to reduce the frequency and intensity of the headaches. All of these different techniques, there's been no evidence that one is necessarily superior to the other. Some children will take to one better than another. Some practitioners are more skilled in one than in another. But indeed, you're quite correct, sir. I'm sorry it wasn't clear enough in my talk. They're very important tools. Do I take the questions, sir? The question is, how does pain management in terminally ill children compare with terminally ill adults? A great deal depends on the setting and the development of the service. So in those places where both services are well developed, they use many of the same approaches in terms of pharmacology. So the opioids, morphine, is a very common used in children who are terminally ill if they have the type of pain that responds to opioids. And a variety of different drugs will be used. Of course, it's not good enough with adults or with children simply to give a drug, because there's a whole context that you want to create that makes the person feel comfortable and safe and feel that they can die in comfort. And the fear of pain at death is probably greater in adults than in children, because children don't really think about it, those things, ahead of time. But again, if they've been exposed to a lot of pain, they may be worried about being painful in death. But they're very similar. The organization has to be different, though, because fortunately, many fewer children die. All adults eventually die, okay? But most children don't. And so that the rate of services, you have to have a different type of service. It has to be more distributed and able to deal with a much smaller population. So it's different in terms of the organization. It's different in terms of the specific subgroups. And children tend to die from somewhat different things than adults do. But fundamentally, the approaches are very similar. Yes? Well, it's a very interesting question, because cry certainly is a very valuable tool for a child to use. They don't consciously think, I'm going to use this tool. But it's very valuable because it is the best signaling mechanism. Come on over here, I need some help. Okay, you cry, people can come and help you. So that is a very useful tool in that way. The use of cry as a simple coping mechanism beyond the communication method has not been explored as far as I know. And there are some very negative things about cry as well. Of course, it expends a lot of energy to cry. And especially in the very young babies who are ill, it can be a significant drain on their energy. It's also something that is... there are some discussions in the literature that indeed it's not very helpful to have a child cry once the signaling is done. But nobody really has looked at cry as a coping strategy that children may employ that I know of. Yes, we'll take a question there. Yes, sir. Right. Question is in terms of what's the physiological effect of pain on the underlying conditions. And we really don't know very much about that. There is a very, in our field, there's a well-known editorial that was in the prime journal of which is called Pain, and it was Pain Kills. And this was commenting on animal studies that have looked at animals with tumors and showed that there was increased metastases if the pain was not managed. So if they were in pain and had tumors, they were more likely to metastasize. But you can understand how those types of studies are extraordinarily difficult and probably impossible. We should never do them in adults or children. So we don't know enough. Is not completely there. However, the work of Sunny Anand, the fellow that did the studies that I didn't mention that compared the surgery with and without anesthetic, did show that without anesthetic, the infants mount a major stress response, and that stress response is in the original two studies showed that they showed a lot of clinical signs that were clinical danger signs. In a later study that he did, which looked at slightly older children who had very serious heart disease and heart complications, were undergoing cardiac surgery, they had to stop the study because there were more deaths in the group that did not receive the very heavy-duty anesthetic regime that they used. So would suggest that there may be, because of this massive stress response that occurs, there may be major negative effects of that and may contribute to the underlying problem, in this case, heart problems. Yes, there was a question down here. Oh. Right. So he... It's not typical. The gentleman's asking is in response to pain, uncontrolled urination. It's not typical, but it's certainly not unheard of, and it would be, again, part of the shock response and the stress of, I mean, just focusing on the pain. But it's not a typical response, but it's certainly not unheard of. There's a question, gentleman beside you? The question is that are there courses to help parents help their children who are quite severely handicapped? Unfortunately, certainly in the province where I live, the services are so poor and so difficult to get that there's some, but very not nearly enough. And certainly in the area of pain, we've only started to do that type of research, and we really don't, in many cases, we don't even know what to do. So, for example, we don't know how to go about assessing a child that is severely handicapped, then is showing signs of pain. You know, we have there's no good research to show, well, these are if they show this behavior, you should do this, or this behavior, you should do that. It's oftentimes depends on who they see. somebody thinks, well, maybe it's in their, it seems to be in their stomach, so we'll send them to the gastroenterologist, or it seems to be in their head, so we send them to the neurologist. It's really not well organized and well thought out at this point in time. So it's very difficult to tell parents what to do. Yes, and then... So he doesn't respond. He says that, no, I'm fine. Right. Well, in some ways, minimizing is probably adaptive. You know, it may be due to the fact that he knows that if he's in really severe pain, that you're going to be able to help him. So he has a supportive network, and minimizing pain and not paying attention to it may be quite adaptive. Now, sometimes it may not be adaptive if something can be done for him, you know, and so that's a balance. But my first take on that would be that indeed the child knows that he can manage fine if he gets into big trouble. He's going to have people to take care of him, so he doesn't have to worry about it. So, yeah, I'm fine. I'll go play with my friends and have a good time. You know, and, yeah, it's cool. And not be, you know, you don't want him to be, and I'm sure you've helped him along, he doesn't want to be a child that is the illness. You know, yeah, he's got this. I got this thing, but, you know, doc, it doesn't matter. It's okay. It's cool. And that type of ability to minimize disability, to minimize the handicap, is really a valuable skill that you've taught him. And, you know, the only risk is that if he minimizes something that is a signal, if it has a signaling purpose that there's something seriously wrong, that something can be done about. So it's a complex issue. And in early studies that we've done, we're now doing some studies on attachment and pain. We're just at the beginning of these studies, and we find that children who are securely attached, who have confidence that their parents are going to be there for them, although the attachment people would say that's a pretty oversimplification of what attachment is, that these kids, for minor pain, what they do is that they take care of themselves. They just go ahead and do things, and that's a good thing. Children who are not securely attached for minor pain tend to panic about it. And for securely attached children, when they have severe pain, they seek help. Insecure children are very inconsistent. They may seek help or they may just hide. They don't know enough to go and get the help from their parents. So that I would say that, you know, that good for your son to do that, as long as it doesn't interfere with things like his medical management. Another question here. Yes. Yes. Very important questions. The question is, is pain response learned, and is there a cultural component? And pain is learned, the response to pain is learned. There's a biological feature, of course, but it's learned. You can't separate them. And we know from studies that our own lab and labs here at UBC have done is that the modeling plays an important role. So, for instance, one study that we did is we had mums come in and their kids, and we had the mums pretend, stuck their hand in cold water. It's called the cold presser test. And the one group of mums was trained to maximize their response. Oh! One group was not given any training at all. One group was trained to minimize their response. The kids watched them for 4 minutes. And then they had a chance to put their hand in cold water. And as you might expect, the parents who showed a very strong reaction, the kids showed a stronger reaction. And in studies that have been done here, in different types of behavior by parents, for instance, when a child is getting a procedure, a needle, if you pay too much attention to it and you say, oh, are you going to be okay, Johnny? Or you know, or if you criticize the child, now smarten up, they will have more pain. They will show more pain behavior, they will report more pain. And that's true, again, in an experimental pain study in some very nice work that Dr. Chambers has done, that reinforcement of different types of pain, the types of context, makes a big difference. It's unclear, nobody's really looked at socioeconomic. There has been some work done on culture, but culture is a very difficult area to work in because, you know, in the old days, people would say, oh yeah, people who are Italian, they wail and they show a lot more pain, and people who are Scandinavian, they don't show any pain. Those studies are more a reflection of the bias and stereotype than they actually, because they never measured what was happening. They just looked at them and said, well, the nurses would say, oh yeah, the Italians, you know. Now, there's some very interesting studies, very few studies in children, but some interesting studies, for instance, a brilliant study, I thought, with Bedouin women who were giving birth. And they compared it was done in the United Arab Emirates or in Kuwait. And what they did was that they observed the behavior and they asked them how they felt. Okay? The behavior was stoic. No response to the pain, okay, of childbirth. And they tell me that childbirth is painful. And when you ask them, so well, of course it hurt, you know, but we don't show that. So I think you have to be careful. There may be some behaviors that are trained up. The other thing I'd caution you, though, is that in any of these group differences, the individual difference far outweigh the group differences. So even if it is true that Southern Mediterranean people express pain more, there are some Scandinavians that will wail and cry, and there are some Italians that will be as stoic as anything. I mean, so you can't use it. It's interesting in culture because you may be able to look at what types of behaviors are encouraged in different cultures, but you can't use it as an indicator of, oh, you're Italian, therefore this will happen. So there's very little literature on culture and pain. You have to look at things about how acculturated people are, whether or not they're in their own country or immigrants. There may be difference between immigrants and people who are in their own country. There may be social class differences. There may be differences between the group of people that immigrated and the people who didn't immigrate. All of these issues, it becomes very complex, and many of the earlier studies on culture and pain really didn't consider those at all. Yes, there was a question up over here. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Right. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. This woman has raised a number of important points, And all of them are around the issues of the context of pain. And the context is so that if you have a pain, let's say, for example, that I have a pain in my chest, okay? And I have a very strong pain in my chest that's sort of like pushing down on my chest. That pain has a very different meaning if I've just stood up from a big meal and I notice this crushing pain in my chest, okay? Here I am, 54 years old, male, a little bit overweight, eat too much, don't exercise enough, and I have this crushing pain in my chest. I'm going to say, God, I'm having a heart attack. I hope I say that, because then I'll get to emergency fast enough. If, on the other hand, I just finished playing a really vigorous game of badminton with my daughter, and I won, my 15-year-old daughter, she calls, when we do play badminton, she calls we play with her best friend and her father. They call us the geriatrics, and we're still winning. A crushing pain in my chest is just wonderful. It's just, I'm alive, I'm feeling the pain, very important. The issue, too, of this issue of paying attention, the difference between a lab test, where I'm saying if you model the behavior, it occurs, and what this woman is talking about in terms of her own situation really points to the fact that the whole context is important and the whole history is important. The importance, so that your child who is confident and secure in themselves is going to be able to say, oh, Mom, go away, don't bother me. Same as she does when you tell him to put on a scarf or to put up his coat or whatever. And that type of confidence is very different. The only thing that the lab experiments are important for is to show that actually even a short bit of modeling can result in increased pain behavior. It doesn't necessarily, and in many circumstances it won't. But very important issues, this context that arises in. Yes, question up there? I'm not sure. I use those terms pretty well interchangeably. And, of course, if I analyze it, management is a broader context, and there may be many different things that are done. And in our pain clinic, when we see children, we run a pain clinic at the Children's Hospital, we always have an anesthesiologist who's also cross-appointed in the Department of Psychology, a physician, a physiotherapy person, a physiotherapist, and a nurse, and a psychologist. And almost always with chronic pain problems that are severely impairing children, we're going to use a bit of each. And that is usually more effective than trying to think that only one solution, one approach is going to be effective. Because certainly by the time we see kids, they're usually disabled by pain. They're usually not attending school. They're depressed. Their sleep is disturbed. They're in tough shape. So we want to use a multiple pronged approach to give management rather than just one type of relief. Right. And oftentimes, though, the things do work. Parents do figure out that the best thing to do is to have the child lie down for an hour when they have migraine. And they work it out with the school, and that works great. We'll never see that kid. But when things start to go wrong, when the kid has migraine and the school won't let him lie down, so he has to be out of the school, and then he gets depressed, he gets behind in school, and complex set of events occur. Other questions or? Oh, sorry. Yes, the question is, do preemies suffer pain from all of when they're incubated, all of the IVs and tubes and such. And the whole area of neonatal pain has really moved along in the last 10 or 15 years. And clearly there is pain from an IV insertion. There is pain from the many medical procedures that they have. What has happened, though, is that the neonatal intensive care units now are quite different. They usually have, they try and make sure that it's quiet. Because it wasn't long ago that somebody would put put down on top of the incubator a clipboard. Crashing noise comes in on the kid, and the kid startles. It wasn't long ago that many babies in the neonatal intensive care unit were just left without being bundled. But it's clear that bundling may help. There's now good research, for example, that shows that sweet taste is a powerful opioid morphine-like analgesic with infants. Doesn't work for adults, although I do like my chocolate just to, in case, you know. But there's been real changes. The bright lights, you go into most neonatal intensive care units now, and the lights are subdued. All of these things have been designed to make their life more comfortable. And there's some evidence that they're more likely to survive and they're more likely to grow faster if those considerations, often called a whole developmental approach, are used with these infants. So what we've done is move from a very hard-nosed technological, which very effective in doing some things, to looking at the context again to make the context more like the one that can best meet their needs. So the bundling, the sweet taste, which of course mother's milk is sweet taste, and the use of lower lights, not so bright, and also the use of quietness and positioning of different sorts. So all of these things have made a major difference, we think, in the comfort of children, and certainly from their behavior it appears that way. Sorry. I'll take this one and then... Yes, and there's been many studies now on the use of, though the question is about the use of a sugar lump many years ago in terms of controlling the pain from circumcision. And there's now been a whole series of studies showing indeed that sweet taste and sucking, using a pacifier, that was one of the other methods that are used now, using a pacifier can reduce pain. Not as good, though, as either not doing the circumcision or not as good as doing a penile block to cut the pain. But it does have a significant effect. This is an example, for instance, in the Bris, where you often have sweet wine. It's not the alcohol that helps, it's the sweet taste. But there's a folk theory that actually is absolutely true. Yes, sir. There is no direct way of measuring pain. Any measure of pain is an indirect measure. If I ask you, it is your self-report, an indirect. If I take your blood pressure or your brain waves, it is, again, an indirect measure. If I watch your behavior, it's an indirect measure. In the children's pain literature and in the adult literature, but I know the children's literature better, physiological measures have not been shown as sensitive as behavioral measures. They're often used in combination to be best. So, for example, if you have strong pain, in the first instance, your heart rate will change. It'll actually drop, and then it'll increase. For a few seconds, it'll drop, and then it'll increase. But after you've had strong pain for 3 or 4 hours, there'll be no change. Your heart rate will be normalized. Until, again, maybe you move a bit, and then you get a sudden spike, and then you'll get a change in your heart rate again. The brainwave stuff, we're doing use of event-related potentials in brainwaves because it's extremely interesting, but we're nowhere near finding any sort of measure. All measures are indirect. We have to choose the best measures. I would argue that behavior is as objective a measure as, you know, oxygen saturation or heart rate or any of those other measures. My medical colleagues are always more comfortable with a physiological measure, and that's because of the whole history of medicine that that's the way it is. But the data show that the physiological measures are not very sensitive, mostly because of habituation. For short, sharp pain, the physiological measures, any number of physiological measures, are really quite good. But the problem comes in the long-term pain, because what you have is a shutdown of the organism, and that you don't get dramatic changes.
One more question, last question for us.
Well, you have to choose.
Well, the only comment is what a fascinating... No, sir.
There was a question up here.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, sir. I can't hear you. As a later life risk. The question is pain in pediatric age group a risk for later on? We don't really know. As I mentioned, there is a series of studies that have been done here that are the best studies in the world that show that at some ages there's increased sensitivity to pain with early pain experience. But the problem is that it's extremely difficult to control for other factors. Kids that have a lot of pain in infancy had a lot of reasons for the pain. So you don't know if it was the pain or if it was other factors that might be involved. And so it's very, very difficult to control. In the animal literature is beginning to show fairly substantial changes, but that may not correspond with later on. There are beginning to show some changes in peripheral innervation where you have had an injury, where you get changes in peripheral innervation that last for quite a period of time. Mariah Fitzgerald has done some beautiful work in that area. But whether or not that lasts for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, we really don't know. It's our suspicion that it might, but the scientific evidence isn't clear. Thank you very much. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a handout at the front here. We did try to distribute them to everybody. If you didn't get one, please come down. There are plenty here to take with you. I'd just like now to invite Patrick's good friend, colleague, and as we've learned, the winner of the Jeffrey Lawson Award, Dr. Kenneth Craig, to thank our speaker. Kenneth?
Well, thank you, Patrick, for an extremely interesting, eloquent, and informative talk. Also appreciate your bringing attention to the work that my graduate students and colleagues in Vancouver are doing, and they're a wonderful group, and it's a great pleasure to work with them. I have to commend the audience for listening to, I think, what probably is a very difficult topic, something that will have induced an element of distress in many of you. I got to reflecting on that, Patrick. We see it all the time working in the trenches, but I don't think too many people are exposed to it. And I just wish there were more of you, because it's an exceedingly important problem, and I think that we can be doing a lot more about it. There are some encouraging things. Patrick had some interesting case studies and demonstrated what can be done for infants, children, and adolescents who are in acute or chronic pain. A lot more needs to be done. I know Patrick and I and colleagues here have been most appreciative to the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, our new federal granting council that is so dedicated to health research in Canada. And I'm pleased to say that the governing council and the scientific directors of CHR are meeting in Vancouver this next week, and that's an important meeting for all of us. I've got a little story to tell. At dinner this evening, Richard Erickson asked why we were interested in pediatric pain, what brought us to that. And I told Patrick I was probably going to tell this story on him at some stage of the game. But last May, the Canadian Pain Society honored Patrick for distinguished scientific contributions at its meeting in Montreal, I guess. And Patrick stood up and gave an absolutely wonderful talk of appreciation. I sat at the table with his wife Anita and his mom and his dad. His dad's just as full of the blarney as Patrick is, and mom was full of pride and just really quite beaming with everything that was happening. And she finally turned to me and she said, "Ken, I know why Patrick's interested in pediatric pain. When he was born, we had to take him away from the hospital right away. I can't remember the reason for that. And he wasn't circumcised until he was 13 months old." So, anyhow, there at least has been a real benefit to us in pediatric pain. Infant pain can have its benefits, I guess. So, thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, well, Ken. I'll get even.
A very special thank you indeed, Ken. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. We'll reconvene next week to hear Bob Hancock from Department of Immunology at UBC, and please have a safe trip home.